all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Christopher McGee, an author of many things naval, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But in particular today, we're talking about a recent book he has penned called Ungentle Good Knights, Life in a Home for Elderly and Disabled Naval Sailors and Marines and the Perilous Seafaring Careers That Brought Them There. Christopher, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's set this up a little bit. You are a professor emeritus at Grinnell College, and you have spent really a career writing about naval topics. But let's go back a little further. You were born in Brooklyn, New York. You graduated from University of St. Thomas in Houston and completed your master's degree from that great school, the University of Michigan, and found your way to Grinnell College and somehow found your way to writing about naval topics. Tell us a little bit about how your academic career pointed you in that direction.
Well, it wasn't so much my academic career as my personal life. My father was a Marine Corps officer in both World Wars. He spent his World War I career at sea on the battleships Minnesota and Utah. And then when World War II came along, even though he was a man 50 years old, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. And there was no keeping him out of World War II, which he spent at Quantico, Virginia, where he was the provost marshal for the base for the majority of World War II. So now I grew up in Quantico, and so I have although I myself have the disability which would keep me from military service, I have a lot of background in military life from my childhood.
Well, that's fascinating, and oftentimes that's what we find here is that there's a family reason one gets involved in certain endeavors. So talk to us about your first publication that you wrote.
Well, that was a book called Edward Preble, who was the commander of the American squadron in the Mediterranean during the war with Tripoli. In the years 1803-1804, he was the commander who led the most aggressive attacks on Tripoli. He wasn't successful in ending the war, but he did inspire a lot of the younger officers who later became famous during the War of 1812. He was a role model for them in a lot of ways, and that was a pretty standard biography. Although I did some things which other people haven't done, which is look at the naval policy of President Jefferson and his Secretary of the Navy by using President Jefferson's manuscripts at the Library of Congress and reading the correspondence between the Secretary of the Navy and the President, which was something people have written a lot about the war, but they never bothered to look there, which I think is one of the salient features of that book.
Well, certainly as a trained professional librarian, that digging into the sources is part of your DNA, and that book was republished in 1996 by the Naval Institute Press, which also has put out the Ungentle Good Knights, which we're going to talk about. But before we go there, again, I want our veteran radio listeners to understand your deep commitment to this kind of work. Let's talk about your second and third publications as well.
Okay, I think it was my second book where I really broke into new ground in a big way. I realized that most naval biography focuses on the famous admirals and commodores. And of course, these people don't win battles by themselves. They have a lot of subordinates who are very essential to their success. And I want to look at the whole officer corps, not just the big names, but the lieutenants and commanders and pursers and other officers who served during that period, and try to get a bigger picture of the Navy officer corps, how basically the theme was, how did the United States, which was a new country in the 1790s, how did it go about establishing a professional naval officer corps? And I think it was, the book was pretty successful in doing that.
And that then led you to a study of enlisted sailors.
Yes, I actually had a chance to go to England for another reason. And while I was there, I visited the Imperial War Museum and realized that they had in immense amounts of information about people who had served as ratings in the Royal Navy in the First and Second World Wars, which nobody seemed to be using. And that led me to write my second book, which was about ratings or enlisted men in the Royal Navy from 1900 through 1945. Again, there were memoirs, there were interviews, there were sound recordings. It was amazing resources that enabled me to really get a feel for what life was like in the 20th century British Navy. Because I wanted not just to be stuck in the 19th century, I wanted to try to get a broader perspective on enlisted life.
Well, and it's interesting because these books allow us to see how life really progressed, how it really was, maybe as compared to how it was maybe romanticized in some of the movies portraying naval heroics during that time. So your research really allows a much deeper look at naval life.
Amen.
That's the shortest sentence he has in the whole book, by the way, listeners. So let us turn then to after you completed your third book, Sober Men and True, Sailor Lives in the Royal Navy, you thought you'd turn your attention to U.S. Enlisted sailors, and probably thought it was going to mirror that other book, but where did the research and the documents take you?
Well, I was spending a year at the Naval Historical Center, which is now the Naval History and Heritage Command in Washington, and one of my colleagues there, a man named Gordon Bowen Hassel, said to me, if you're interested in enlisted men, you really want to look at the records of the United States Naval Home in Philadelphia. And Gordon was right. I had imagined a book, a very different book. And in fact, I actually tried to write the rather different book, and it crashed and burned. So then I decided to do what I had originally, I had originally thought about trying to do a book about just about the records from the Naval Home. But I mentioned it to a good friend, and she sort of edged away. And I thought, that doesn't sound like a good idea. Well, actually, she's now read the book, and she's on my side. I found out that what was important about the group of men who went, it was called the United States Naval Asylum in those days. Now, that didn't mean asylum in the sense of a place for someone who was insane. It meant an asylum as a place of refuge. And it was established, let's see, where should we begin on this? I'll say the reason for going here is that when you look at most sailors in the 19th century Navy, what you're going to get is a glimpse of them at one point or another in their lives. They get into trouble and there's a court-martial, or they do something heroic or they're involved in a battle, but you only get a snapshot of them at one point in their lives. You don't get their whole life. The advantage of the records of the United States Naval Asylum is that, the records of the United States Naval Asylum, to get in, you had to create a record of your life in the Navy. And that was supplemented by, in the 1850s, a group of energetic officers who were stationed there, talked to a lot of the older sailors, and I learned about their lives before they joined the Navy. So that for the men who the men I studied at the United States Naval Asylum, you can follow their lives from their teenage years right up to their deaths in most cases.
Well,
and that was the
I found this interesting because you really end up being able to tell an individual sailor's story, and many of those stories kind of ring true today. But before we get to those stories, I want to back up for a moment and let our listeners know. Christopher, this U.S. Naval Asylum had a rough time getting off the ground, and the concept of finding a the government creating a home for these sailors, was it widely adopted? Talk to a little bit about the challenges of the country meeting its obligations as it related to these folks.
Okay. Well, the first thing to remember is that the sailors paid for this themselves. Every month's pay, 2 cents was deducted. I'm sorry, 20 cents was deducted for a naval hospital fund. Now, it's very hard for us in the 21st century to imagine the purchasing power of 20 cents in 1798, but it was, of course, a lot more than it is today. This went into a fund called the Naval Hospital Fund, and about 1811, the fund had gotten big enough that the Navy was thinking about it. Always had sort of ad hoc hospitals at various Navy yards and so forth, but actually building naval hospitals as we think of naval hospitals today was first thought of in 1811, and a bill was drawn up authorizing that using the money in this fund that had been created. So no congressional money went into this. It was all paid for by the sailors themselves. Well, at that point, the War of 1812 intervened, and the money got used to fight the war. It wasn't until around 1824 that they got back to the idea of building the naval hospitals. And then there was some back and forth with Congress and the accounting people about where was the money, how much should there have been, and so forth. Congress eventually wound up paying back the money that had been used to fight the War of 1812.
Well, that's one part of this, Christopher, that I think rings true today is sort of this, government accounting and money that's supposed to be set aside for veteran purposes, and they find out, after some period of time, who's got the money? And then they have a whole multi-year dispute about how much money the government ought to put back into the kitty to say it's where it was supposed to be. And I think those who are today talking about VA and how much funding needs to occur to actually take care of people could read this and go, that's 100 years ago, but it sounds like it's today. I found that very interesting.
I think it does sound familiar, and the whole idea, we're not quite sure where this money went, but it didn't, was just one of the fascinating things. I didn't devote a lot of attention to that, though, in my second book on the officer corps. My favorite chapter, though probably wouldn't be anybody else's, was the one on the Navy's accounting system. But anyway, back to the sailors at the naval home. Yes, and then so finally in 1831, in the late 1820s, they began building. They were going to build the law provided there would be didn't say where, but there would be a number of naval hospitals. They wound up building one in Boston and Chelsea. Was one built at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. One was built in Norfolk. One was built in Pensacola, Florida. Now the one was built in Philadelphia. The law specified that one of these homes was also to provide a retirement home for long service sailors. And it turned out to be the one in Philadelphia. So the building in Philadelphia actually, until after the Civil War, shared the facility for the retired sailors with the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. And of course, if the elderly sailors became ill, they seamlessly moved into the hospital.
this retirement home for the sailors, they had to qualify for, and it's sort of interesting to read how even the qualification identified problems with how old they really were, where they served, the records weren't very good. And again, I fall back to, I find a lot of, talking to a lot of vets today who go, yeah, my records are all screwed up. And we look back 100 years and go, they were screwed up back then. But it was a problem getting qualified into the retirement home, wasn't it?
It was. Actually, I have to say the Marine Corps did a better job. The Marines kept very good, the adjutant kept very good records on Marines. And boy, he could just fill out a form and show where they, how long they served and pass it over to the Secretary of the Navy's office. And these guys were in, zipped into the Naval home. But the Navy did not maintain continuous records on its enlisted personnel. The only record it had was, okay, you signed on the Constitution, you served from 1812 to 1815. You got paid off. And that was, they didn't, there was no connection. They didn't connect. Maybe you served on the Macedonian in 1818, but they didn't make any connection between those two. So they had no continuous personnel records. So if you wanted to get into the Naval home, you had to say, well, this is what I remember about my service. So I think, and then they would turn this over to the accounting officers, who would go through the muster rolls and see if what the sailor remembered about where he served actually matched up with the payrolls or the muster rolls from those ships, and often it didn't. And so but the Secretary of the Navy had some discretion, and it looked like this person probably, and there are a couple of discrepancies in the records, but it looked like this person really served his 20 or 30 years in the Navy. Then they would go ahead and let them in. I should also mention another important point. If you had a pension, you could surrender that pension and be moved and move into the Naval home. Now, before 1869, pensions were only given for injuries. So if you, let's say, had lost a leg in a battle, or more likely, actually experienced a severe hernia during your career as a sailor, you could get a pension for that. And then you could then say, I want to surrender my pension and move into the Naval home. And that was where the person who was in charge of it, Admiral Joseph Smith, was worried a great deal because there were a lot of pensioners out there and there wasn't enough room for all of them in the facility in Philadelphia, which generally ran about 200 people at a time.
One of the other things that I found interesting in reading Ungentle Good Knights, put out by the Naval Institute Press, and we're talking to its author, Christopher McKee, is that many of the problems, as you tell the stories of these sailors in the U.S. Naval home, the problems they encounter are eerily similar to the problems I've heard over time from veterans in today's veteran homes, which are primarily run by states. But that includes sort of this broad category of drunks and liars. Talk a little bit about the problems that you were able to document in the records from these men in those categories.
What, in age and where they were from?
But yes, both in age, where they were from, and then the problems they had staying in the home, in the U.S. Naval home, because of such things as, going out of the community and getting drunk and getting tossed out.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, first thing is, there's no greater and more dangerous historical quicksand than sailors' self-reported ages and self-reported places of birth. It wasn't a society where you really needed to. In the 19th century, you didn't really need to remember when your birthday was when you were born. Your Social Security wasn't dependent on remembering that date or a lot of other things. So they often, and if you were trying to enlist, it was to your advantage to make yourself a little younger than you actually were. Trying to get into the Naval home, well, you might want to make yourself a little older than you were. And some of these guys, I think, they didn't have any idea really how old they were, within maybe a 5-year range. And also, theoretically, and we had a Navy which was staffed entirely by native-born Americans. Well, we didn't. It was a lot of people were immigrants who came to the country. Many of them never became naturalized citizens. They just landed and then joined the Navy and they became Americans. And there, primarily, they were people from Northern Europe, England, Ireland, Scotland, Germany, Northern Scandinavian countries. These were people who just naturally sort of melded into the American population. And then, of course, the biggest problem at the naval home, by far, was the problem of alcohol abuse. And that we could talk for half an hour about that. As you know, until the beginning of the Civil War, the Navy served a ration of grog, that is a mixture of alcohol and water, twice a day to every sailor on the ship. And this became controversial because it did lead, in the opinion of most sober observers, this made a major contribution to promoting alcohol abuse because these people were used to. Now, grog, I should say, in this book is the only place where you can find out how strong that actually was. There's been a lot of ink spilled about grog, but it turns out that it was, they used a rye that was 50% alcohol, and then they mixed that with an equal amount of water, and they served it twice a day. So that it meant that twice a day you were getting a hefty glass of a beverage that was 25% alcohol, and a lot of commanders felt that kept sailors' morale up. Other people, like Admiral Joseph Smith, who you know is one of the heroes of my book, felt that it was a very bad idea, and it led the innocent into lives of alcoholism. And I think the treatment of alcoholism in this book is one of its strong points.
Well, and again, I think it's one of those historical facts that ripples down through history and time, and you can see many of those same problems today with veterans self-medicating for a variety of reasons, and certainly grog allowed you to self-medicate a little bit to take care of those aches and pains and medical problems that a very rigorous life as an enlisted sailor would have been at that point in time. But unfortunately, it would also result then in, if you were found to be drunk and otherwise violating U.S. Naval Home rules, you would get tossed out of the Naval Home. But it goes, I wanted you to
if
talk.
You were if you were bad enough. I mean, you had to. There was a lot of looking the other way, as you know, and you had to really try at it. You couldn't just do, coming in tipsy wouldn't get you tossed out. Coming in tipsy and hitting an officer would get you tossed out.
And interestingly, you discuss in the book a number of instances where that Secretary of the Navy discretion comes in, and some guys were better than others I might have got tossed out, but I've been able to petition the Secretary and get myself back in. I thought that was a set of interesting facts that the records revealed as well. Maybe you can expand on that.
Well, some of these guys who worked through their, there was a congressman in Philadelphia who was especially helpful, and he would intercede for some of these people, and that was good too. A couple of them knew people who are from importance, and they would work that. A couple of them just did it apparently on charm. If you remember the story of the sailor who was caught with the prostitute in his room on Christmas Eve, while everybody else was at dinner. This was obviously a guy who if I may use the comparison, a Bill Clinton bad boy charm, because he was kicked out of the home, immediately went down to Washington, was never allowed to return. Well, as it turns out, never was 8 days long, because he trotted down to Washington, applied his charm to Admiral Smith at the Bureau of Yards and Docks. And the next thing he knew is he's on his way back to the naval home and readmitted. So, Admiral Smith, who we haven't talked much about, who was chief of the Bureau of Yards and Docks and was the one to whom the naval home reported, he said, I'm a friend to old sailors. And he really was. he was the kind of guy who would put up with a lot before he would really say, okay, that's it, I've had it, you're out forever. But he was, and he has the reputation among naval historians as a kind of tough guy, because when he was an executive officer and a commander, he was pretty a strict disciplinarian, but boy, once he started running the naval home, he was really very understanding about people who'd been sailors, especially if they could say, I remember I served with you on the Ohio. Okay, well, that was sure to.
Well, those stories of those individual men, some of them are quite charming, and I think that you capture that in the book, Ungentle Good Nights, put out by the Naval Institute Press. Your excellent research and writing historically has been recognized. You've received the prestigious Commodore Dudley W. Knox Medal for continuing lifetime achievement in the field of naval history. I think you were the 11th individual to receive that honor, which is considerable for your work in the field of U.S. naval history. I guess as we come to a close, what do you hope people learn from this book and its look at this slice of history?
Learn who real sailors were, because up to this point, enlisted history has been written primarily from sailor autobiographies, and we could spend 15, 20 minutes talking about how unreliable those are. And some of them are not even written by sailors. There were obviously people who had some knowledge of the Navy who wrote these up and pretended they were sailor autobiographies. And those have been the stock in trade that a lot of historians have used to understand enlisted life. And in fact, some historians, I will not name any of them, have actually presented the ones that were actually fakes as if they were real autobiographies. These are all real sailors. This is what people really want to know what it's like to be a sailor in the 19th century, in the early days, in the 19th century U.S. Navy. This is, I hope, an accurate picture of sailor life, and that's what I want people to get out of it. And if you want to go ahead and extrapolate from that to later periods based on one's knowledge, go for it. But this is an attempt to say, well, this is what naval enlisted life looked like in the period up through the Civil War.
Well, I want to thank you, Christopher McKee, for taking some time to educate our veteran radio listeners about this book, Ungentle Good Nights, and what real sailors did and looked like in that period of time. I appreciate your time today.
Well, all I can say is I hope that people will get their hands on the book and read it, because I write books to have them read.
We appreciate your time, and it's certainly a great read.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have it. It's been a very enjoyable half hour, which has shot by. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I had a lot of fun writing this book. I've had more fun writing this book than any of the others, and I really am very happy with it. The Naval Institute Press did a beautiful job. As you know, you've seen a copy with the production of it and the colored end papers and everything. It's just a gorgeous book. And fortunately, the price is low enough that, you know, it's not gonna frighten people off from buying a copy, hopefully.
Well, again, thanks for your time this afternoon. I'm glad that you squeezed us in.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans. And you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.